Thrive and Thrive would like to begin by first acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land of which we recorded this podcast and extend our respect to elders, past, present, and emerging. I have a monkey mind, which means I get distracted and lose my thoughts easily. So I'd like to talk to you about Notion, a productivity software that allows you to track projects and the other cool stuff. I've been using Notion for about a year now and have loved the freedom it gives me in my business. I'm a proud Notion affiliate as it is my one-stop shop for the back end of my business and my brain when I'm not using my brain. Does that make sense? I didn't think so. See what I mean by a monkey mind? I use Notion as a database and a way to track my programs, clients, and projects. If you're looking for a digital tool for your team, personal use, or business, you can check it out on our affiliate link in the episode description. Start today and get organized for tomorrow. Hello and welcome back to another episode. First and foremost, I want to express my deepest gratitude to each and every one of you for being part of our growing Arrive and Thrive career podcast family. That was a bit of a mouthful. Your support means the world to me and I truly appreciate your valuable time and attention. If you're finding value in our content and haven't already done so, I want to invite you to hit that subscribe button and become a regular part of our community. Also, feel free to leave a little review as well if you're that way inclined. Your subscription and review is a vote of confidence in what I do, and it fuels my passion to deliver the best content possible to help you and others thrive in their career. To subscribe, simply click the subscribe button on your favorite podcast platform, and you'll be in the loop with each new release. Now let's arrive and thrive together and have a little roar. Vari McKechnie, welcome to the Arrive and Thrive Career Podcast. Did I say it right?
Yes, you did.
Yes. I want to make sure I say everyone's surname on this podcast correctly. And Vari, tell us about who you are and introduce yourself to the listeners.
Thanks, Ty. So I do a few things, which used to be something that I hated when people asked that question of, so what do you do?
It's a very Australian question.
Yeah, I never felt like I had this like, you know, elevator pitch kind of like snappy little soundbite to give people. But now I kind of just embrace the fact that I do quite a few different things. So firstly, I'm a coach and a writer, but my background is in design. So I'm also a designer, a creative director, and I do illustration as well. So I used to feel like they were all such separate parts of me, but I've come to realize that they're all just slightly different flavors of what I do for work. So yeah, I've embraced that line of I do a little bit of a lot of things.
Yeah, I love that. We're big believers here on the podcast of the portfolio career. So you're in a good company here, Vari, with that type of approach. Talk to us first about, I suppose, your involvement in the design space. Like, how did it all begin?
Yeah, so art and design was always something I was interested in all through school. My mum often jokes that first report card from school when I was like five said Vari likes to draw and colour in. And then I went on to do a design degree, which, yeah, you know, the writing was on the wall, I think. So I was always really interested in that. I played a lot of sports when I was younger as well. So I think a lot of people just assumed I would kind of go on that track of sports and become a PE teacher. But for me, it was really important to have that to be separate from my work. It was something that I just loved as an outlet for me that was separate. So design felt like the thing that I wanted to really focus my energy and efforts on from a career point of view. So I went to uni in Glasgow and got a degree in design and kind of started on that path then. So I worked for a national publication in the UK. I worked for an agency and an in-house design position there, which was great. So I kind of worked in a few different areas of that and then moved to Australia in 2007. And I got a job which at the time was my dream job. I was working for IMG, doing all of the branding and design for all of their events here. So things like the Australian Masters Golf, that very infamous one though, where Tiger Woods came out.
Ah.
I was responsible for the logo design for that and all of the branding. Hilariously, side story here, I remember at the time me having all of these like grand ideas of like these beautiful invitations we could create for the gala dinner that they were hosting for Tiger. And everyone kept saying, we just don't have budget for that this year, but next year, we'll do it next year. Little did we know what was going to happen in the weeks that followed that particular tournament for Tiger. And so, yeah, it was really my dream job because I got to combine the sport aspect that I love and also the design as well.
I love it. Just on that, I love how you said it was your dream job at the time.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So true. And it was really great. I was new to Australia. I had just moved here. It was a great way to meet lots of new and interesting people. So yeah, it was a dream job for the time that it lasted. And then I went off on maternity leave to have my first son, Gabe, and I was made redundant from that position whilst I was on maternity leave.
Oh, wow.
Which at the time was terrifying, you know, a new baby, a new mortgage, all of the things that come with that. It was a pretty scary time, but I had always known that I wanted to be my own boss and do my own thing. If I'm entirely honest, I was a really shit employee.
Love the honesty.
When I look back now, I was like, yeah, my bosses must have been super annoyed with me. Because I was always asking for more budget, more things. Like, I was always coming up with more kind of outside of the box ideas about things. And when you're working, you know, in a very kind of corporate space, you don't often love those ideas. Not that that's always the case, but certainly it was the case for the organization I was working for at the time. So it was great freedom for me to then go off and do more freelance style design work. So I kind of, went down that road, worked as a freelance graphic designer doing branding and website design for a lot of other small businesses. So that's kind of the direction that my design career took me in. And then I started to be more interested in the coaching side of things. So for me...
And was that like a natural progression from... You know, when you're working with clients as a designer, trying to pull information out of them and kind of understand their values, understand their insights around what their branding wants to communicate is...
Yeah, there definitely was that. And it was kind of this like parallel approach to it. So at the time, you know, my first son was just little. Then I was pregnant with my second son. There's just 2 years between my boys. And so for me personally, I was kind of on this journey of like, you know, this new season of my life and what did I want to focus on? And, you know, who was I as a mother, as a designer, as a woman? And so I was kind of on this personal growth journey, and then I had the business part as well. And so I started to see that the two things couldn't be separated in the way that so many of us try to separate, right? We're like, we want life to be pretty over here and we want work to be pretty over here. But so often, especially when you're doing your own thing, there isn't such a kind of stark, you know, differentiation between the two. And I think we can cause ourselves a lot of stress and a lot of grief and heartache by trying to keep them separate. So for me at the time, I was kind of on this personal journey and learning more about myself and what was really important to me and what my own values were. And as I was working with design clients, I found that at the time, a lot of my clients were coming to me from the States and from the UK. And it was mostly through networks that I had made in different business programs, things like that, that I had kind of signed up to be a part of to learn more of the business side. And what I started to do was, you know, this was in 2009. So this is, you know, pre-Zoom days by a long shot. So I'd wanted to have my own design studio, but I didn't necessarily want to have this like bricks and mortar like studio. I didn't want to manage staff. I didn't want to have to like deal with all these big overheads. I just wanted to make some really good profit and work from home.
Fair. Is that too hard to, I mean, is that too hard to ask?
Yeah, exactly, right? It's like, you know, the kind of like, you know, the kitchen table office when the kids are asleep. I did that for quite a few years, you know, hoping that they'll just sleep for 10 more minutes because you have this presentation to finish.
Know that feeling.
Trying to beat them up in the morning and you never quite got to it, you know. It was this battle of like who could get up first. And so back then, you know, it seems wild to talk about it now because it's just such a part of how we live and work now, especially in post-COVID times. But I started doing these presentations over Skype. Remember Skype? Mm.
Yeah.
I would present designs in PDFs and email them to clients because they were, you know, in different parts of the world. At the time, that was like sci-fi. It was like the wildest thing to do, you know? Because I remember like working in an agency and like, you know, making these big like A3 presentations and mock-ups of things.
Oh, and like flip books and things like that.
Yeah, like real physical stuff. Yep. You know, this is like, you know, early 2000s. I'm sure it's a lot more digital now, even in that space. But I remember it just being this really kind of practical, physical thing. And here I was trying to like present something over Skype, you know, with slightly dodgy internet connections, which we don't seem to have got past now. I feel like this is still a problem we have. And so as I was doing that, a lot of the other people in these different networks and groups that I was in kind of saw that I was doing this and they were like, you know, I'm a creative person as well, whether they're, you know, a designer or a writer or, you know, someone that did websites or something like that. People in that creative kind of freelance industry were curious about how I was doing this from my house in the western suburbs of Melbourne for clients that were, you know, in New York and Chicago and places like that. So it kind of naturally took that direction where I started like unofficially kind of mentoring and coaching these other, mostly women, mostly people who either had small children or were planning on that being part of their life in the next couple of years. So it started to kind of morph more into that. And then I realized how much I actually loved that space and sharing some of my own experiences and a lot of the trial and errors that I had gone through. And so, I started to move more down that path. I went on to become a certified coach and dive more deeply into the different kind of concepts and structures that I could use for that. But it always was drawn on this personal experience of mine at that time as well. And so I think a lot of the clients I attracted as a coach, I was just a couple of steps further down the path than they were.
Yeah.
And I realized that really early on. And it's something that I've always kind of positioned myself as. I'm not, you know, the guru that's going to tell you how to fix everything, but I'm someone who's just a few steps further down the path that, you know, can help you where you're at in this season of your life. So, yeah, there was this really natural kind of transition from the design work into more of the coaching work. And I thought to be a legit coach, I had to like completely give up the design side of thing and do the coaching 100%. And I see this with so many of my clients, like, we don't give ourselves the permission to feel successful unless we're doing this one thing 100% of the time.
Mm.
And I think it's so damaging to people because those other things like give value to that one thing that you think you should be doing. So, you know, back around to what we said at the start, like this idea of I need to just be a coach, I can't also be a designer. And I was like doing these like covert design projects, not telling anyone about them, you know, like I kind of had to out myself. I'm like, I'm also doing design projects, guys.
Yeah.
But I saw how much value that was to my clients because I wasn't just someone who had a business who then got a coach and thought, this seems like a sweet deal, I'm just going to be a coach. Like, it was actually working in my favor that I was still working in the way that these people aspired to work in. So I was kind of like walking the walk as well as teaching people, you know, how they could potentially structure their business to do the same thing. So so it took a while to give myself permission to be that and do that.
I love that, Vari, because I think that's so common. Like, a funny thing happened to me the other day. Like, Chess, my eldest daughter at daycare, they were talking about what their parents do for work and what family members do for work. And my wife was at the dinner table and she goes, what should I put for you? And I was like, I don't know. Like, you know, I'm always wrestling with this identity thing. And it's so refreshing to hear that you went through the similar thing. It's like, well, I'm a podcast host, but like I do a little bit of coaching, but then I do a lot of facilitating, but then I run like a careers education company. Like, it's just this constant kind of layering thing. And I agree. Like, I think a lot of young people, particularly still, like, it's like, what are you going to do when you finish school? What are you going to do when you grow up? It's like this kind of phrase. It's this one thing. So it's really refreshing to hear your story too. It's like something that you've gone through yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we're trying to get to that like destination point, which we know that we never get to. And if we do get to it, we're too busy looking at the thing that's down the road and around the corner, yeah, you know, yeah. Like we're never fully satisfied when we get there. Funny story about that. I remember flying from Melbourne back to Scotland to visit family when my dad was sick. And I remember getting on the plane and they had, I'd flown economy from Melbourne to Dubai and then got to Dubai and they bumped me up from Dubai to Glasgow into business. I remember thinking, this is sweet, like traveling without kids. Like yep. These are the things that happen when you don't have little people that you're wrestling with. And I remember sitting in that front row of business and like peeking through the curtain and being like, I wonder what happens up there. Like, yeah. And I was like, hold on, like just be happy with where you're at. But I was like, literally like, if this is the food we are getting here, what are they serving up there?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think like, it's just such a beautiful example of like, we're never happy with where we get to because we're always just as humans curious about what's around the corner, you know? Yeah. So I think to acknowledge that you're in that place of it always changing and shifting. And that can often be a result of all those other factors of your life, you know, especially with family and the ages that kids are at and how much, you know, time you choose to dedicate to that. I think it's this ever shifting and evolving thing. And this idea of trying to find balance, I think is bullshit. Like, the idea of balance is that like everything is stable and steady and not moving. I don't really think that's how we want to live our lives, you know? So for me, it's more about finding the rhythm of things. And that can look really different in different stages of your life. But there's always that thread that weaves all of those things together, you know? Like you said, with those different roles that you play, like there's that thread of like, you're a connector, you're a communicator with people, you know? And I think when we can get back to that, it gives us permission to let that look different ways at different times and take on different forms and not just be the static thing that we think we need to kind of like set as our North Star and do everything to get towards. I think we're far more creative than that as humans. And I think that's what makes for an interesting life.
Yeah, that's cool. That's really cool. And you are an author as well as a part of your business identity or personal, as you said before, crossover between just your identity, full stop.
Yeah. Another string to my bow. Yeah,
love it. And the book's called Seeds of Courage.
Yes, it is.
Talk to us a little bit about that, and because I love the sections that you were talking about, you know, tilling the soil, sowing the seeds, and allowing the bloom.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's pretty cool. And being a little bit of a green thumb myself, I was like, oh, I can relate to these from a practical sense. But love to hear you unpack that a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. So writing a book was always something that I had a dream of doing, and I think so many people do, to be able to share a part of our story. I think they say that 83% of people want to write a book and less than 3% actually do.
Whoa.
It. So I feel like
you're in the 3%.
Gold starred me for actually doing it. But it was something like books, reading has always been a huge part of things that I love, both in a work capacity and for me personally as well. I've never met a library I don't like. I still have a card from a local library and I go all the time and my kids are so embarrassed by it.
Oh,
I'll come home with like a stack of library books and they're like, oh God, Mum.
Knowledge is power, kids.
It's about $200 worth of books here and we paid nothing. and so like when I was a kid, I would often go to bookshops with my dad. On a Sunday afternoon in Glasgow, there was this one in particular. It was like over three floors. And we would go in and I would go to like, you know, the kids teen section and my dad would go off and like my dad had books on every subject under the sun. And we'd just spend hours and then come back together and he would have a little pile and I would have a little pile and we just would go home and read our books. And so I remember like being in those bookshops and being like, how do you do that? Like, how do you put your name on one of those things? So from a really young age, it had always been something that I had been excited to kind of play in that space. And so just through my work, coaching and also my own kind of personal writing and also for my newsletter, I started to think that I potentially had a book in me. So me being me, like wants to like take the action yesterday, hired a writing coach. I went through three different outlines, three different chapter summaries, hated all of them.
Yep.
And I was like, maybe now's not the time for me to write a book. But at the same time, I had kind of launched myself into this creative project of writing 100 notes over 100 days, and I recorded them as audio versions on the podcast as well. So I was feeling a little bit creatively stuck at the time, and so I thought this will be the thing that will kind of fire me up and kind of re-engage me with that writing part. So long story short, I wrote the notes. We only got to day 50 because of other kind of synchronicities that happened within that. But when I got to the end, I thought maybe this is the basis for a book here. Sent it off to a publisher. They loved the idea. And as they say, the rest is history. It kind of went from there. And so for me, with the whole concept of the book is we need to slow down before we speed up. You know, this idea that like we think that in order to get to where we want to go, like we have to have this bulletproof plan of how we're going to get there. So seldom does that actually happen, you know. And so for me, really being able to dig into like, what do we need to release and let go of and create more space around so we can have more availability to those inspirations and those synchronicities. And so those three parts that you mentioned, that, you know, tilling the soil, making sure that we create that space, and then getting really intentional about, right, the space that we've created, what do we actually want to plant in that space? And, you know, that goal that we had 5 years ago, is that still relevant now? Or is it something that we can just let go? We often don't give ourselves permission to just like leave those goals behind, you know? And so then moving through that stage of where we kind of plant those ideas and those seeds, and then actually allowing them to bloom. And this is a thing I see with my clients, and I can recognize in myself as well, is that we don't allow it to get to that stage where we get to allow it to bloom. You know, we often like plant the seed and then we dig it up 2 days later and then we want to plant a different seed somewhere else, you know? So we keep changing the things that we plant and wondering why nothing is blooming, you know? And it's often like we have this glass ceiling of like not allowing ourselves to kind of realize that and have that, which sounds crazy because we're like, of course I want the thing and the money and the bank and the partner and the kids and the whatever it may be. But we often keep switching lanes and we don't give it that kind of gestational period to get to the point where we get to see, you know, the results of that work that we've put in. And I say work, but I mean allowing that process to unfold. You know, this idea of endless hard work and hustle and grind, like I've completely unsubscribed to. And I think that idea of allowing there to be more time for things to unfold, and giving ourselves more time to rest. Not just sleep, but to rest. We think that we get rest when we sleep, but we so often don't allow ourselves to have periods of rest during the day. So for me, that's been a transformational thing for me. And so I wanted to bring that together in the book and kind of look at that cyclical process that we go through of making sure that we are first creating that space and we have that intention before we move forward and we're not just trying to keep up with our own ideas, often at the detriment to so many other parts of our life.
Yeah, cool. Because a little motto that I've really tried to buckle down on myself is this process of slow growth. And I feel like that kind of relates to what you're saying before, is that I feel like we're so quick to change plans or we want something instantly. Because we get everything else instantly. Like, you know, we want something from Amazon, we click on that, it arrives the next day. You know, we want instant feedback in our work, in our family life. But quite often the most important things take time. And so, yeah, I love the fact that recognizing that you need to be able to, you know, allow it to actually bloom first and being patient in that process.
Yeah. I think having that gestational period, you know, when we plant the seed in the ground, we don't expect it to, you know, to be a pumpkin the next day. Yeah, like we trust that it's doing its thing and it'll be ready in a certain amount of time. And I think if we can adopt that in our own life and be like, right, just because I had this idea today doesn't mean that it should be here tomorrow. And maybe I just needed that idea for the idea to go down this path. Yeah, and it might not end up in the result that I expected when I first had that idea, but it's taken me on a particular direction to either cross paths with someone or for something to, you know, be an epic fail for me to take a left turn instead of a right. So I think trusting in the unfolding of those things is something we're just not very good at. I think we want our brains to know exactly what that plan looks like. But allowing for those synchronicities, allowing for that magic, you know, when I see it in my own life, it's quite magical when you can see, you know, the unfolding of those things. But people around you are entirely uncomfortable with it. This is what I've come to realize. Because when friends, and they're like, how's work? Are you busy? And I unsubscribed from the busyness quite some time ago. And especially my mum will say this, are you keeping busy? And I think it's a generational thing as well, you know? And I'll say, mum, I don't get busy. Like I might be full sometimes, like I'm ever really full week, but I'm not busy. Like I don't want to be busy. And people don't enjoy that. Like people are like, I want to know you're busy. Either because they are busy and they want to know everyone else is busy, or because they think if you're not busy, like something terrible is going to happen, you know?
Or you're not making money, or you're not, you know, reaching your potential, or...
People think you're lazy. People, when you're like, I'm just going to... Because I have these, what I call Freedom Fridays, which is a choice whether I work or not. So I don't have any client calls on a Friday, but sometimes quite often I'll have the idea for a podcast episode or something. So I often do find myself doing some work on a Friday, but there's nothing scheduled in. So it's, there's kind of open space there. And people feel really uncomfortable about that. And they're like, are you not busy enough to work on a Friday? And I'm like, no, I could, but I choose not to. I choose to orient towards that spaciousness rather than filling my calendar with, you know, back-to-back clients every day of the week. So I've found that that is a pace that I work better at, and I'm someone who does need a lot of solitude and a lot of open space for those kind of ideas to bubble up to the surface. But yeah, people do not take kindly to you saying that you're not busy.
Hello, friends. When I'm not hitting record here on the podcast, I'm delivering career management and life design workshops in schools. So far, we've supported over 45,000 individuals and counting since starting in 2019. We're in 100 schools across Victoria, a few in New South Wales, and a couple in Queensland. But we still have so much more to do. Growing our community member base is a huge focus for us, as our mission is to help all young Australians develop meaningful careers and live a fulfilling life. If we can teach young people important career management and life skills early, we hope that these skills will serve them well into their life post-school. Hooray! If you're a teacher, educator, principal, or school leader looking to add a little extra career education and entertainment to the curriculum, check out our workshops at arrivethrive.com.au. You can download our program brochure, learn about our workshops, see our prices, and read what teachers and students have said about us and how we can support your community. Thanks again for tuning in. It's like what we were talking about off air too, before we hit record, around certain lifestyle choices. And one thing I want to unpack with you is the choosing to be sober. And it's that when we make a choice and we project that to family and friends, they kind of go, oh, what do you mean? Like, is something wrong? Or is like, they, I feel like quite often people are very, negative is probably the wrong term, but they're like looking at it from like, oh, there must be a reason why you have to do that or have to do that. It's like, you're not making a choice, like you're making a choice, a subconscious choice. So you're making a subconscious choice to have a Freedom Friday. And I feel sometimes people get frustrated because they might not have that choice themselves. And then it's like they have to justify it in their mind.
Yeah.
Love to get your insight on that, around what you've noticed on that journey of choosing to be sober, and also I suppose how you work with your clients to kind of get them to be comfortable explaining certain choices they make to their family and friends.
Yeah, definitely. I think that potential judgment or just reflection from close friends and family members can be a really difficult thing, and it's often the thing that holds us back from doing what we most want to do or we feel most drawn to, because we've created this identity of who we are and it's working for everyone, you know. It's this little kind of ecosystem and it works, and when you suddenly are someone different, there's a grieving process for those people in your family because you're no longer that version that they felt comfortable with, you know? So there definitely is that transition time I've found. And so for me, I have gone through quite a few of those transitions in my life. And two of the biggest ones are probably when I chose to remove alcohol from my life and when I chose to end my marriage and kind of reformat our family into a two-house co-parenting family, which is the way I kind of like to look at it, as opposed to being divorced, being a single parent. Yeah. And I think just on that, like, those words we use are really important. So I don't identify as someone who's sober or someone who's in recovery. For me, those aren't really useful terms because they feel like the attention is on the thing you're trying to push away, which doesn't feel like the way that I want to live. I want to move in a way that feels more drawn towards things I do want as opposed to pushing away the things that I don't want. So I like to identify as someone who just doesn't have alcohol in their life or who lives alcohol-free. The same is true for my marriage. I didn't identify as being divorced, being a single mother or a single parent. I was someone who was a co-parent and our family just looked a little bit different. So I think the words we use to describe our situation is really, really important. And there's different energies to those words. And that's something that comes up with my clients all of the time, you know. There can be these kind of culturally popular words that we use, and it can be helpful in ways. You know, I have used the term sobriety just because it is something that a lot of people connect with. But for me personally, it didn't feel like who I wanted to be in the story that I wanted to tell, because it felt quite a helpless story. And I didn't feel helpless in my decision to remove alcohol from my life. It felt like a really empowered one. And so I wanted to make sure that energetically I felt that as well moving forward.
Yeah, fascinating. And how have you dealt with your own mindset around, you know, being in Australia? There's obviously I believe we have a big drinking culture. It's like, you know, have a couple of beers on the weekend or have a drink with the girls on a Friday night or whatever it is. And I've found that whenever I've chosen to do, like, say, a month of no alcohol, and it's something that I try and do, you know, at least once a year, and people go, oh, why do you want to do that? You know, oh, it's, you know, it's just one drink, like, who cares? Like, you know, don't be such a stiff. And it's like, well, and I actually find it uncomfortable because I part of me is like a bit of a people pleaser. I'm the kind of person that if other people are having a good time, I'm having a good time type thing. So how'd you deal with, that? And can you share any insights around your own journey on that one?
Absolutely. And such a good question that I could talk endlessly about. Going through that transition from being someone who was first and last at the bar every single time to someone who just didn't drink at all was quite a leap from one end of the scale to the other for me. So what you said about there being a big drinking culture in Australia, I think I didn't fully realize that until I moved here. So I feel like I was kind of dealt this like double whammy where I was like Scottish and we have our Scottish reputation for being like the biggest drinkers, bar maybe the Irish, but I think we tried to like give them a good run for their money. My mother's family's Irish, so there was no hope for me. And then coming to Australia and there being this really big drinking culture here. And so I felt like I had this kind of like, you know, these two fronts to fight when it came to my identity as someone who was Scottish and Australian and also didn't want to drink as well. So it was kind of hard for me to reconcile those in my mind at the time. But moving forward for me, you know, I had done a couple of those month-long dry Julys, Feb fasts, all of those things. And I found them really easy. Like I could do them because I'm someone who, like, if I kind of set myself a goal, I'm pretty good at just like following the steps and doing it without there being too much drama attached to it. I'm an actually very competitive person as well. Ask my kids when we play board games. I once knocked one of my children's tooth out with a footy. So a little insight into the sport and competitiveness. And so I found that pretty easy to do, but when it came to making that decision to remove alcohol entirely, I wanted it to be more than this just quick run around the block, as I describe it in the book. I wanted it to be more of an identity shift away from it. So for me, I say that I was an accidental daily drinker, and I think a lot of us can relate to that. You know, I would say that I would just curb my drinking and I would only drink on the weekends, or, you know, I would take the car to this event, so I would only have one or two, and then I would drive home. The car would inevitably be parked outside of the pub. I'd have to Uber it home and find a way to get the car the next day. And so for me, there was this like endless self-negotiation all the time that I just didn't want to do anymore. So I started to consider, well, what would it look like if I just didn't have to continue to like make these decisions around drinking, and it just was like a non-issue in my life, which terrified me because I'd never really experienced life without alcohol, you know. So as I started to kind of move into that, it was a random Sunday evening. It wasn't some special day. And I poured a glass of wine and then I just poured it down the sink and that was it. And that was just gone 5 years in July.
Wow.
Which my life is still very similar in many ways, but also completely different in many ways as well. And so at that time, that was July, it was coming up for my 35th birthday. I was flying back home to spend time in Scotland with my family, and I was going to New York to a wedding with my then partner, where I would know no one at the wedding. And I remember thinking to myself, if I can get through these things without alcohol, like, I'm good to go.
Yeah, so that was like your own challenge of, you know, that competitiveness come out.
Yeah. And so that was all within probably 2 months of not drinking. And I remember getting home from that trip and thinking, I can actually do this. Like, it doesn't seem like such a big thing. And I wouldn't say that I had an addiction to alcohol. I just had a really tenacious habit with it. It was just a habit that I couldn't really shake. So this accidental daily drinking, I would get up in the morning and be like, right, I'm not going to drink today. And then before you know it, you're making dinner and there's a beer in your hand or there's a glass of wine, you know? And so I started to realize just like how much of a kind of recurring theme it was in my days. And I didn't want to have to do this negotiation all of the time with myself. And also at the time, you know, my boys were getting older. Their dad and I had separated. So we were, you know, a two-home family at the time. And I started to become acutely aware of the fact that there were times where I was the sole responsible adult for my sons. There wasn't the backup of the other parent being there. So if I had, you know, been at home and we'd had friends over for dinner and I'd drinking a bottle of wine and we went to bed, if something happened with the boys during the night, there would have been no one available to drive them to the hospital if that were the case. And so I started to become more and more aware of that. And also just the example that I was showing for my kids. You know, growing up in my family, there was a lot of alcohol for a lot of different reasons, both to celebrate and to commiserate. And when we were happy and when we were sad, like there was never an occasion where alcohol was not a good idea. You know, it might be because it's Friday night or because it's someone's birthday or because it's Tuesday. Like, you know, it didn't really matter. There was never an occasion where drinking wasn't a good idea. And so I wanted to kind of break that cycle. And I guess in my family, there were people who are, you know, very high functioning, but there was definitely a dependency to alcohol. And then there were some that were less high functioning, which is easy to look at that and say, I don't want that. But when you see an example of someone who has a really successful business, who has a really great family life, but alcohol is this kind of ever-present thing, it's kind of hard for you to see why you should remove that.
Yeah, interesting.
So for me, I wanted to kind of break that cycle for my kids and just see like what would it look like if just alcohol was just not a part of our life and part of our family. But certainly that reflection from other people. When I went back to Scotland when I was just newly alcohol free, my mother was convinced I was pregnant, and I thought like this is something that will work itself out.
Yeah,
like people want to know the reasons why. Yeah. Like my mom said, like, oh, did you have a big night recently and you're off it for a while? And I'm like, well, I've had probably one or two too many of those big nights over a really long period of time. But no, there's not one night. And then secretly in the kitchen, she's like, are you pregnant? And I'm like, also no to that. And I thought like, there's no trying to convince her of this, because this is something that like time will tell, that in 9 months time when there's not a child there, like that wasn't the case, you know, 5 years on, still no extra child. So, you know, and so, yeah, it's really uncomfortable for people to see that. I remember we were going out for a family dinner when I was back there. And my mum said, oh, we'll get a couple of taxis, you know, and we'll go to the restaurant. And I said, well, you know, people can just hop in the car and I'll drive. And people are offended by that. Like, they feel like you're not as invested in the night out. You're kind of sitting on the outer a little bit, or you're judging them for drinking. It's a really interesting place to observe from. But I realised that I would rather feel more comfortable in myself than spend my time trying to make other people feel more comfortable about me choosing not to drink alcohol.
What were some of the differences that you noticed within the 5 years, in terms of your work output, social connections, and general well-being?
I mean, it's not surprising to say, like, every area of my life definitely kind of up-leveled.
Yep.
After that, there's definitely an awkward stage in the middle there, you know, like when you're kind of out in public as this newly alcohol-free person, like you feel like a bit like, you know, Bambi, like trying to find your legs a little bit. I love, like, the thing is, I love the pub scene, like growing up in the UK. I love going to a pub on a Sunday afternoon. I kind of love the environment of that. I love how inclusive it is for so many people. And so I didn't want to kind of like completely close that off, but I just wasn't going to like drink the alcohol in that environment. So so that was interesting at first when you would go to the pub and I found myself saying, I'll just have a soda and lime. And I was like, just, you need to drop the just. Like, like I'm almost like kind of covertly like apologizing for the fact that I'm not drinking alcohol to the person serving me in the bar who couldn't give a shit drinking alcohol or not.
And almost like apologizing to yourself too.
And the people around me are like, oh, just have this, you know? And so I started to just own the fact that like, I'm going to have a soda and lime. And it's been really fascinating in the last 5 years to see how many more non-alcoholic, you know, options there are in bars and restaurants and stuff, which has been amazing. But there were a few around. They weren't particularly great when I was kind of newly sober. But for me, I didn't want to just switch from drinking alcohol to drinking non-alcoholic versions of the same thing, because I knew there had to be like a routine change, and there had to be that pattern interrupter for me to kind of step into that new space. So I consciously didn't look for like the non-alcoholic beer version in those times. And now, you know, I love a non-alcoholic beer as much as the next sober person. But at the time, I didn't want to just like make that switch. Like I had to be in that uncomfortable phase. Not long after I stopped drinking, the relationship I was in then at the time, like we went our separate ways, and I realized that a big part of our connection was around alcohol. You know, we would go out for dinner, we'd go to bars, you know, we'd spend a lot of time in the city, and it was a big part of what we did socially together and with friends. And it's not to say that our relationship couldn't have, you know, continued after that, but there just wasn't that same alignment in that time. So we did find that we kind of went our separate ways with that. Stepping back into the dating pool as a sober person is a fun and interesting time. It was so interesting because I remember not advertising the fact that I didn't drink, because I don't care if other people drink. I just choose not to drink myself. But I found myself on some hilarious dates with this one guy. Told me it was a Sunday afternoon that we met in a pub in St. Kilda. And I remember him telling me how he'd spent like literally thousands of dollars the night before, had only got in at 5 a.m. And I thought, like, this is not a match here. You know, maybe I should lead with, I choose not to drink alcohol. And so there was that awkward time of like, kind of like trying on that new identity as someone who didn't drink. And now it just is part of who I am. A lot of friendships did last that transition of me going from being someone who drank to someone who didn't. But many of them did dissolve, and not really in dramatic ways. But I found that for me to choose to stop drinking, often people saw that as a reflection of like their own drinking. So if they looked at me and they considered themselves to drink more than me, and I felt like I needed to stop drinking, what did that say about them? You know, and so there was definitely some kind of friction in a few friendships that, that as I say, just dissolved and didn't really kind of sustain through that transitional period, which is all good, right? You know, when we become someone different, we have to expect that there are going to be some people leave our life and some new people come into our life. And that's definitely what I recognized with alcohol, is that it does change a lot of those facets. And from a work point of view, like my creativity just went through the roof. You know, I just had
more
capacity.
That is a common theme I hear, Vara, yeah.
Yeah, just having that spaciousness, you know, and not being hungover or on your way to being drunk, you know, like having more space in the middle that we wouldn't ordinarily have. Was huge for me, and I didn't not expect it, but I didn't expect it to the level of that clarity and just excitement I had around my work. I think that's the best way to describe it. There was this new excitement. It didn't feel, and I've always loved the work that I do, but I didn't feel like there was this like obligation. I didn't feel this like heaviness around it. Like I just, ideas were sparking all over the place and I felt really excited about work again. Mm. And people think that you're boring if you don't drink. My life is far more exciting and interesting without alcohol. I was entirely boring when I was drinking because you're just doing the same thing every weekend, you know? It might just be in a different setting, but I know you pick up more hobbies, you do more interesting things. Like I do fun and crazy things with my kids. I went back to playing sports again. Like you bring back those kid-like things that you really enjoyed. And you're not just being someone boring who's drinking at a barbecue, in the park, at the beach, at a winery, in a pub.
Yeah, yeah, it's such refreshing points because, no pun intended there, but I always hear, you know, friends and myself, like it's always like I've had to justify it. So, you know, I'm trying to save a few bucks or trying to be a little bit healthy or trying to, you know, trying for kids or whatever it may be. But it's like that conscious effort just to be like, no, it's my choice and that's what I want to do. It's such a shift.
Absolutely. And not having to justify your reasons or try and convince people why it's a good choice.
Yeah.
That's something I've learned in so many different areas of my life, to just be able, if you're offered a drink, to say no and that be a complete sentence. Like it's not a no because or a no but, just to say no thanks and then move on and not give it any more meaning than that. And the other person might choose to give it more meaning, but like, for me, I can't get involved in that, you know, like all I can say is no, thank you. And then move on. But we feel like we need to justify it, especially when we have had that identity as someone who, you know, was the life and soul of the party. To all of a sudden you're choosing not to do that now is definitely a shift. But I think owning that awkwardness is just part of it. You know, it is going to be awkward because, as I say, it's like kind of trying on a new pair of shoes. Like you're never quite sure how it's going to land or if you are going to feel awkward. And there was times where I would do like, you know, the back door exit and go home from the pub because I was like, this all of a sudden just got real messy. Yeah, and I'm like, I don't really know
how to. This escalated very quickly.
Yeah, there's that point in the night which you're not as aware of when you're in it.
Yep.
But there was a few times where I was like, and this is the point I make my exit, you know. And no one even notices at that point, you know, so.
It's one last question on this because I do find it particularly interesting and I'm the first person to put my hand up and say, you know, I enjoy having a couple of beers with mates and that kind of like excitement that comes with that. Like how do you go, for lack of a better term, but how do you go partying when you're choosing to be sober or not drink?
Mm.
Because I've often found, and maybe it's my mindset that I need to work on when I am choosing not to drink. But it's like I go, everyone's having a good time. Here I am just choosing not to, but geez, that looks fun.
Yeah. And there's been one or two moments like that for me. One in particular was when I was newly sober and I went to New York to this wedding and I was with the partner I was with at the time. He was doing a job in New York City as well. So I had this day to myself in New York City, just wandering around. And I met him in this like hotel bar after he finished the shoot that he was on. And it was this beautiful bar. It was in the middle of summer in New York. And I was like, God, a cocktail right now would just be perfect. And I remember thinking at the time, I won't have one just now. We'll go for dinner. And if I still want to have a drink after dinner, we can always come back and have one. And so it was that kind of moment where I was like, oh, do I, don't I? And so we left this bar, walked down this street, and there was this like Italian food festival and then this little alleyway. And it was just like the most fun night. And we just ate our way all the way down this alley. And it was so much fun. And I just completely forgot about the idea of wanting to have a drink. So for me, it's that like delayed gratification, you know, and knowing that retrospectively, I'm like, there will be moments where I'll be like, God, that looks good. Like, you know, when you're at a beautiful winery or it's a wedding or something, like just to be able to enjoy a glass of wine or enjoy a beer. But I kind of like to like fast forward and be like, right, tomorrow morning, will I be happy with the choice that I made to have a drink, or will I want to be someone who chose not to? So kind of like, you know, taking yourself to that future place. And for me, it's that delayed gratification, you know, those natural pleasures that come with it. And that was one of the beautiful benefits that I didn't realize when I stopped drinking, was just how time just slows down. Like I say in the book, like it slows to the drip of honey. Like time just takes on this new texture and this new rhythm, which was just unavailable to me when I was drinking. Everything was just like urgent and there and right in front of you and next. But like I would naturally wake up earlier in the morning, and I started to realize that those things would feel so much richer in the long term than that kind of short instant gratification of a beer or a glass of wine in the moment. So it can be really hard to have that perspective when you're in the moment. But what I realized was that, you know, often alcohol makes shitty situations and environments feel better, right?
Yeah, escapism.
Absolutely. Like if you're on a night out or you're, you know, at a wedding and you feel like you need to drink to have a good time, it just means that the night out or the wedding is pretty shit. And alcohol is the thing that makes it seem better. It's not that it's better with alcohol. You just perceive it as better because you're looking at it and experiencing it through this filter of alcohol.
The beer goggles.
Absolutely, right? In all the ways.
Yeah. Sunglasses, whatever you want to call them.
Absolutely, yeah. So, you know, and it takes a while because I kind of, you know, dove into like the science around it, and the dopamine hits that we get from alcohol are huge. You know, they're so much greater than our body can naturally cope with. And it takes a while to kind of re-regulate those dopamine receptors so we can be available to those slower, more natural, you know, hits of pleasure and excitement that we get. And it takes a while to kind of reorient ourselves towards that. For me, it was like around rituals of like, you know, making a cup of tea or enjoying my cup of coffee in the morning. And I know it sounds like the most boring answer in the world. People are like, who's going to choose a cup of tea over a glass of wine? Like, it's not even a competition, right? But it takes a while. Like, I realized that. I was like, right, this cup of tea is not going to feel the same as like a beautiful glass of wine. But allowing myself to like slow down and enjoy those more natural pleasures, you know. And I would watch my sons, especially in the summertime, I'd watch them playing on the beach. And everyone thinks like a summer without alcohol is like, you know, the worst time in the world. But when I would look at my sons playing on the beach and like alcohol is not playing a part in their experience, and they were just having this beautifully fun and present time. They weren't like trying to escape anything. They weren't wondering what was next. They were just like fully in the experience that was happening, and I wanted more of that. So it definitely made me more playful, more joyful, like more kid-like in those things. Also from a work perspective, I was like, you know, I'd find these hobbies, like I made some macrame wall hanging thing, and I was like, maybe this is my new business. Like, I was like, slow down. Like, you can just have hobbies. So it made so much more space for hobbies and creative things. And as I say, going back to play sports, was a huge one for me that I would tell myself I didn't have time for, but it's because I was choosing alcohol over those other things. So it definitely takes some effort to fill the space that you create when you do remove alcohol, but it's so much more interesting and so much more creative and so much more sustainable. You don't have those highs and lows that you have when you're drinking.
Yeah, it's that process of prioritization, isn't it? That's what I'm hearing. Like, what do I prioritize? Am I prioritizing, you know, the immediate short-term effect? And yeah, that looks fun, but you know, in terms of all those extra benefits that you get, you're prioritizing so much more.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, what I realized was, especially for women, you know, around my age who had young kids, what a kind of toxic culture there is around alcohol and this idea that alcohol is required to endure parenthood. You know, it made me really angry to see a lot of the media and a lot of the advertising that was so clearly directed at young women who were newly mothers, who are already in a really vulnerable place. And they're now being told that in order to survive this, you have to have, you know, mummy's juice or whatever. And all these like ridiculous, you know, slogan T-shirts or, you know, like rosé all day and all of these things like. Yes, they're kind of funny on the surface, but I think that cultural narrative that runs underneath that is really dangerous, especially for a lot of young mothers who, you know, are dealing with huge lifestyle and identity changes, and also, you know, many of them dealing with postpartum depression and things like that, to then tell them that you have to place alcohol on top of this just to get through it is entirely incorrect, and I think really harmful for so many people, and why they find themselves in this kind of accidental daily drinking phase, and they don't quite know how they got there, but they don't really know how to get themselves out of it either. Mm-hmm. Because mother groups and, you know, all of these things are revolve around wine, and it was so true for me. Like, my mother's group would get together in the local pub on a Friday afternoon with all of our little tiny babies, you know, so it's kind of like sold as this glue that holds life together in those early years. Oh, I don't believe that to be true anymore.
That's really interesting. I've just had a bit of a light bulb moment, because one thing my wife and I do at the moment is we send each other like Instagram reels of like funny kind of parenting situations and dad perspectives and mum perspectives and everything in between. And my wife, the ones that like quite often the mum perspective ones, there's always like an element of alcohol in it. So it's like, you know, there might be a quick reel on, you know, the baby gets their bottle and mum gets her bottle type thing. Mm-hmm. And it just what you're saying there is so, I find so true, having been like a young parent, or being a young parent in that process right now, like people go, oh, you deserve a drink, or, you know, you deserve a cold beer, or, you know, it's now time for you to relax, go get yourself a glass of wine. And yeah, I would imagine where, like, if you, yeah, for someone who's not that comfortable on saying no to those types of things, it'd be a real difficult bind.
Yeah, it really is. And you see it, like, even in the wellness industry and stuff, you know, where there's these yoga retreats, but there's also wine involved in it, you know, or even like alcoholic kombucha. Like, we take something that's meant to be really good for you, but we have to make alcohol a part of it to make it seem better and more exciting, you know. I think once you kind of look at parenting through that lens and see how much alcohol is woven through it, yeah, it's pretty concerning. I remember, just as you were saying about you sharing reels with your wife, there was one that I saw online a couple of weeks ago, and it was reposted from one of the kind of meme accounts. And it was these women sitting around a table, and there was a little toddler there, just, you know, in his nappy and a bottle. And he was chugging the milk.
And everyone's yelling, chug.
Yeah,
yes,
Barry,
I saw
chug,
that.
Chug. And I remember just being like horrified by it. And I reposted it on my account and just said, really, like, because someone had said legend or something, like, this kid's a legend. And I was like, really? Like, is that what we are considering to be legendary? You know? And I get, like, on the surface, yes, those things can be funny. You know, I don't want to be the fun police to say that there's no humor in that. But I think we need to be conscious of the example that that's setting, you know, for those women and other women, and also for kids growing up. Like, what relationship do we want them to have with alcohol? I think we need to take our responsibility as adults, whether that's to our own children or the children that we just are, you know, interacting with, it maybe nieces and nephews, or, you know, if we work with kids in schools. I think to understand that we actually have a responsibility to model good and healthy behavior around that. So yeah, that was one that, and it got some really interesting comments and a lot of unfollows, which I'm more than happy to have. But I think, yeah, until we kind of really examine that, I think it's a really dangerous thing for us to be kind of subconsciously being an example of to our kids.
I remember there was a couple of commercials a few years back around, I think it was by the TAC, around that culture of like, oh, son, go grab me a beer. Or, oh, honey, can you just grab the wine bottle for mum? Like, yeah, I think and that kind of peaked, and now I haven't seen any commercials like that for a long time.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because I remember seeing that ad on TV. I think you're right, I think it was for the TAC, that the men are at the back at the barbecue and they send the young boy in to get a beer,
mate,
in the
go
fridge.
Go grab some beers for the boys type thing.
I remember seeing that, and this was before I'd stopped drinking. I remember seeing that, and I'll be brutally honest here, and thinking, I don't see what's wrong with that. Like, why is this a thing? Like, that's a completely reasonable thing to ask your kid to go and do. And so, yeah, already, you know, that was a little ahead of where I was personally on that journey. But I think it's not to shame people who don't necessarily see that there is some really damaging messages in there. You know, I think people who maybe don't have that same level of awareness or don't have that personal experience can look at that like I did then and be like, hey, there's nothing wrong with that. But I think it's just being curious and not, you know, we live in such a cancel culture these days that, you know, often if people have even a, you know, 1 degree different opinion than we do on something, it's so easy just to kind of close those doors and shut those opinions out. And so for me, I'm glad I was curious about that. But yeah, I absolutely was someone who thought, this is entirely acceptable. There's nothing wrong here.
Yeah, I definitely think it was a conversation starter too, because I remember even a few family members and close friends like who had young kids at the time were going, oh, I'm just mindful of how much I drink around my kid and things like that, which, you know, was the first – I was – oh, yeah, I wasn't probably in the zone that I am now with parenting then. But it kind of got me thinking of going, oh, that's really interesting. I'd never thought about that type of, you know – example that you're setting with just going to, like, you know, ask your kid to get you a drink. Yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah, and I think it's that more, you know, the example we set as opposed to, you know, the instructions we give. We can tell our kids to not drink, but what are they seeing us do on a daily basis, you know? It's that longer term effect that they have. So recently I had the opportunity to ask Deepak Chopra, of all people, a question, and I wanted to ask a question around parents and teens specifically. How do we help them kind of navigate technology in a healthy way and have their kind of own spiritual practice? And in typical Deepak way, I wanted like a 7-point like infographic. And Deepak responded by saying, you know, they're not going to listen to a word you say, but they're going to follow in your example. Yeah. So don't tell them not to do it, but you just live by example. And eventually they'll catch on, which was entirely, you know, unsatisfying at the time, but I also know it to be true.
Yeah, it's so true, isn't it? Like, I've heard that similar quote with parenting, like, kids won't listen to what you say, they'll act on what you do. Mm. And, yeah, I'm just noticing with my daughter at that age of well, Penny's a little bit younger, but even one, like, she's starting to pick up on behaviours around our home, and but Chess being, like, 3.5, like, she's a sponge. She is like saying things, repeating phrases, and a bit of a story. I stuffed up this morning. This morning was a little bit stressful for our household for a range of different reasons, and I dropped something and I said the F-bomb, and then Chess just repeated it straight away. And I was like, no, no,
of all the words of the morning, that's the one she...
I was like, no, duck, duck, goose, like, and that was like the first thing that I grasped. And then Ali started going, Daddy said a bad word, and I was like, Daddy made a mistake, duck, duck, goose, like, type thing. And so you got to be so careful, and that's just with the language that you're using, but, you know, the behaviours that we're demonstrating.
Yeah, and I think a great example of that is, you know, often at Mother's Day or Father's Day, kids at kinder will, you know, do little lovely things for their parent, and it's usually, you know, what does Dad like to do, or what's his favorite thing, or, you know, what's he best at, and you get these hilarious answers. So often, especially on the mother's ones, mummy loves wine, mummy loves to drink wine, mummy loves to have wine with her friends, or whatever it may be. And and again, we all think that's funny and cute, but like, these are kids that are like 3 or 4 years old, and when they're asked the question of what does mummy like to do, the default answer is, you know, mummy likes to drink a wine, you know? Yeah. And so I think as much as it's often quite a light conversation on the surface, like, there are definitely deeper impacts that it's having with our kids. And, you know, my kids were older when I did stop drinking, but it's really beautiful to see the conversations now that they are a bit older. You know, they're 11 and 14 now. So, you know, I'm not naive to think that alcohol is not going to play a part in their, you know, pretty imminent future. And I'll try to be that parent that lives by example. But I know just being that example for them, and them seeing, hopefully, they might say otherwise, them seeing someone who lives a fun life and who has different things going on and who's not, you know, the boring parent, I hope I'm not, for them to see an example of that just shows them that, like, it doesn't have to be this, like, alcohol equals fun equation that we so often think. And, of course, they're going to go out and experiment and, you know, make all of their own mistakes, which they absolutely have to. But I feel really grateful that they have a different example in me and in a few friends that also choose to not drink as well.
Fantastic. Vari, I've really enjoyed our conversation. Thanks so much for coming on. Last question I want to ask you, which, you know, is a little bit of a segue in on our podcast, is the what are you roaring about? So I'm just going to play Dan's theme music.
Taco. Taco. I'm roaring.
He called me Taco. I still don't know why.
I'm soaking it up.
Taco, just thought I'd drop you with a little late night surprise for you.
I'm not sure if you can hear the sizzling. I'm just sort of stewing on that.
Thoughts?
I'm roaring.
So, Vari, what are you roaring about at the moment?
Such a good question. There are a few things that I'm roaring about at the moment, but I would say the biggest one is, I touched on it earlier, getting back to playing sports, like, has just been ridiculously fun for me this last 12 months. I love that our weekends have now become like Noah plays soccer, Mum plays volleyball, Gabe plays tennis. Like, and I went to a tournament for the weekend and my boys were with me that weekend and they had to come and spend 12 hours each day in a stadium watching me play sports, and I kind of love that, like, there's
shoes
no
on
balance.
The other foot now, boys.
Exactly. I'm kind of clawing back some of those invested hours over the last, you know, 14 years. But it's been such a beautiful thing for me to get back to. I played volleyball when I was a teenager. I went off to the States and played there on a scholarship when I was younger. And then I let it go when I had kids and, you know, life got full. But I got back to it last year and it's just been ridiculously fun. And to have my brain work in a different way, and to, like, be really present and not be attached to phones and devices and stuff has been, yeah, pretty incredible. I just turned 40 last month and my teammates range from 15 to 24. And then there's me who's 40, which I actually love.
That's cool.
And again, it's been a beautiful thing for my kids to see. Like,
yeah.
I was really nervous about going back to play. Like, I played at a fairly decent level, you know, represented Scotland under 21s and stuff like that. But it'd been so long that I was like, shit, what if I've forgotten how to play? Like,
yeah, yep.
And I remember the night before the first game that I played, I'm like Googling the rules, like watching like Dr. Steve, someone, the coach of some university in the States, like, explain a 5-1 formation. I was like, shit, I've forgotten all
this stuff.
And so for me to go back and be that example to them of like, I'm really, really nervous about this, but I'm going to do it anyway, has just been the most fun. And to get to play with these like young women who are still playing competitive sports at those, you know, tender ages of 17, 18, and they're navigating exams and all of that stuff. It's been beautiful because if it weren't for the sport, our paths would never have crossed. So all that to say, this Sunday, I get to take my two sons to the State Awards Gala dinner because being the 40-year-old in the team, I've been nominated for MVP for the league.
Fantastic.
And it's just so playful and so fun. Like, it's just been such a beautiful thing to kind of like show them and experience with them. I drag them along to training during the week and they just like go off and play together. It's the only time in the week they play together because they're just like an empty court that they like have to do something on for two hours. So that's definitely what's making me roar at
the moment. Fantastic. And if people want to get a copy of your book and to learn more and perhaps engage your services and listen to your podcast as well, how can they find you?
Yeah, sure. So all of my links are on my website. It's just varimckechnie.com. At the moment, I'm just working with clients in a one-on-one capacity. So so you can find out more about that on my website. And my podcast is just the Vari McKechnie podcast. So you can search that wherever you get your podcasts. And the book Seeds of Courage is available on online, so you can just check it out, Google it, ask your local bookseller or your local library to order you in a copy. It's available wherever you prefer to get your books.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Vari, for coming on.
Thanks so much, Ty. It's been a pleasure.